make sure. Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is December 7th, 2018, Pearl Harbor Day. And here with Kathleen Mike Dalton, her home in Fairbanks, Alaska, and her daughter Libby is also here with us, and the dog Izzy may cause her normal disruption. We'll see how it goes. So, Mike, you had something in particular you wanted to start with?
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the News Miner.
Okay.
They may not want me to, but...
No, that's on my list, so go for it.
Well, after we had moved down from Barrow to Fairbanks in 1954, early 54, we didn't have a house to live in, or housing was kind of hard to find. You could live in shacks, but I didn't want to live in a shack. So we, what are those apartments on 10th Avenue?
Dixon
Apartments.
Dixon Apartments, okay.
They're still there.
They're still there.
They look pretty good, too.
I think we lived in apartment B2. And living next door, no, above us, was the Wilkin family. Gary Wilkin mm-hmm. and his brother Bobby. And Steve, I think the other boy's name is. Doris Wilkin had been personal secretary to Judge Jay Rabinowitz for many years. That began when he was a Superior Court judge, probably earlier. At any rate, she was with him all the time he was Superior Court judge, and then he became a Supreme Court justice, mm-hmm. and she moved on with him. And Gary was... of course, real tall, sports hero in high school. He later in life became interested in politics and was elected to the state senate, where he did an outstanding job as a member of the finance committee. Mm-hmm. His son, Bobby, is noted locally for his brewery.
Right, the Hoodoo.
Hoodoo Brewery.
Right.
So I don't know who the other boys are.
What was Gary Wilkin's father's name?
Robert.
Okay.
One interesting thing that happened, kind of sad, but they liked to be outdoors. They were real... healthy family. And in the wintertime, they'd ski, and they'd also go ice fishing. And they had a van, a closed van, so they went out to their ice fishing hole one day. And the ice got real warm underneath, and the van sank. That was... some lively news at Harding Lake.
I'm sure it was probably not the first time it happened at Harding Lake.
I'm sure it wasn't.
Yeah.
That has no significance. It's just something that happened.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget when we were living in Arctic... was that the name of them?
Dixon Apartments.
Dixon Apartments. I was sitting at the table in my little kitchen, and the three boys, I could hear them coming. They lived upstairs above us. I could hear them coming down the stairs. So I looked out, and here's Gary, the larger one, and Bobby, second. Wayne was the other boy's name. And they took off across the lawn, and all of a sudden Wayne just stopped. He pulled out his britches and peed on the lawn. It was so funny. It was so typical of little boys.
Yeah, little boys who are used to being outdoors.
Yeah. But that reminds me of somebody in Tanana. I was doing some interviews in 1973, and I went over to Tanana and interviewed a few people there. I knew some of them, but I didn't know a lot of them. But it was, that's the wrong village. It was Rampart. I went to Rampart. Rampart is known for its beautiful women.
Mm-hmm.
So once there was one person there I interviewed, and her name was Antoinette. And she had a twin sister. Antoinette was about 80 or so. Antoinette and her sister, when the steamboats had come, they'd go on the bluff, waved everybody. They were known all up and down the Yukon as the beautiful twins. I never saw a picture. I had a picture of her at age 85 or 90. I'm not sure how old she was. I'd have to go back and look at my notes. So what I did was, the spring, we had a bad breakup on Yukon where ice jammed and it backed up into Rampart Village. Sometimes it just backs up in and forms dams in the river. And then the ice jams from above come down and there's no place for them to go. So big chunks of ice are broken off and they tumble over. Go up to the bank, and if there's a cabin or anything in the way, they just run over it. Well, they'd had a bad ice spring, so a lot of things were damaged. And there was one log house that had just missed destroying it. But it was the place where the marshal had kept his records. So I thought, well, that would be interesting. Just look at some of the. It was really interesting. They were just big ledgers. They were stored in this little log. The little log house was maybe 15 by 15. That was all that was in it. So I got down some of the log books and started going through them. What Wayne's little self-relief there reminds me of this one. So I started reading through some of those cases. This was back in 1898-99. And there hadn't been any American law anywhere, except for Judge Wickersham, who occasionally went chugging by on the Yukon River. But they'd send the marshals out when they had problems, so. The marshal was the law, I guess, and one of his deputies came into court one day with a young native man. And the magistrate, or whoever it was, said, what's he in court for? Well, he peed on First Avenue. What do you mean he peed on First Avenue? Well, he just stopped in the middle of the street and peed, which is a common thing for them to do, but they're trying to introduce some civilization to Rampart. He said, no peeing in Main Street. But he had just come in from a village, and that's what they did in the village. They had to go pee, they peed.
Right.
End of that story.
So was that Antoinette Roberts or Mayo? Do you remember?
Might have been Mayo.
It's a familiar name, that's why.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering. I don't know who her sister would have been, though.
But all the people knew of the beautiful twins,
uh-huh.
even when they were small, until they grew up.
Yeah. What was the twin sister's name?
I don't know. I have it in my notes someplace. Mm.
So you moved back to Fairbanks in 1954 from Barrow. Or from Umiat.
Yes, from Barrow.
From Barrow. Then when did you start working for the News Miner?
I started working for the News Miner about 1961. Because I wanted to work. We needed an extra income.
So was your husband still working for Arctic Contractors? Or he was
no, that had terminated.
Okay.
That time, he started working on a report for the Alaska Industrial Development Board.
Was Dew Line over by 61?
Well, by 54, when you moved back here, was Dew Line finished?
The Dew Line, yeah, we went back up north in 64. On the Dew Line.
Oh, okay.
And that ended in 57.
Oh, wait a minute.
It was 54.
54.
And then
the Dew Line 54 to 57.
Yeah. It ended in 57, so we're back in Fairbanks.
Okay. So 1957 to Fairbanks from Dew Line. Okay. And then your husband started working on this report. So he had a job.
Yes. So I decided I wanted one. So I went into the News Miner and talked to the editor and said, I'm looking for a job. He said, what can you do? Oh, I could write a little bit. My grammar is good. Oh, well, we like people who have good grammar.
Who was the editor?
Was it Sneddon?
No, he was the publisher.
Oh, okay.
I think the editor at that time was George Sundberg.
Oh, yeah, I know the name. Okay.
He had been editor before. So he and Sneddon didn't get along too well, but he was a good newspaper man.
So did you apply for a specific job, or you just...
No, they said, well, we'll show up tomorrow and we'll give you... a pad and pencil, and you can go out and cover something for us. So I did. So that was kind of an introduction to nothing.
Do you remember what that first thing was that you covered?
No, I have no idea.
Okay. So then what happened?
Well, I never got fired, so I guess they figured I could write. But I did have good grammar practices.
Excellent grammar.
Yeah.
You still correct people.
I'd like to correct more people. Mm-hmm. So I started working there, then, and that continued till 1st of April 1970.
Who were some of your co-workers?
Some of the co-workers were, Karen Perdue came aboard as a junior editor. She was in high school. Hmm. And then she moved on to Senator Ted Stevens' office as an intern, and then as a staff member.
Oh, I didn't know she did all that before she did her health and social services and her university
stuff. Oh, yeah,
stuff.
She did. Oh. She moved from job to job. Ended up making a lot of money.
She worked her way up to the top.
Yep, she did. Who else did worked with you at the News Miner?
Don Dennis was a sports editor. And Chuck Hoyt was a sports writer.
Did you guys have a photographer, or did you do your own picture?
When I first started there, we had no photographer. But there was one man who lived here in Fairbanks who had a professional photo studio. And if there was a murder or news event coming up of a great interest, the news monitor would just hire him to go cover it.
What was his name?
His name was Phil Hoon, H-O-O-N. I still have a lot of his negatives.
Hmm. Who worked back in the press room and ran the presses and stuff?
Well, one I know of who's still active around was Leroy Shanks.
Hmm.
He worked in the press, on the presses.
Was it a daily paper? Every day?
Daily.
So were there people in the press room who put out all the letters and...
No, they were the ones who printed the paper.
Did it have to be put out with all those little letters into a printer, or it was a more modern system?
Yeah, we used linotype process.
What's that?
Yeah.
Can you explain it?
There is a machine with a keyboard, and it has lead slots that have lead on one side, and they go down as the operator types go down and fall into a frame, which will be a story or maybe a whole page.
Okay.
And when you try to read them, they're all upside down and backwards. So you soon learn how to read upside down and backwards.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a real skill if you want to go to some lawyer's office and stand there and read what he's writing.
I guess I should be careful when I'm taking notes. You could read upside down and backwards.
Was there a Associated Press, like a, you know, what they call those machines?
Not ticker tape?
The Associated Press was active. That was our statewide news source.
So you'd pull things off the wire, or is that how they say it?
The teletype.
The teletype. Hmm. So what exactly was your job?
Whatever they wanted me to do.
You were the main reporter?
Some days, yes. One Saturday, the editor was so desperate for a headline that... He asked me to come up with a headline. I said, I don't know, nothing happened. One time I stepped out the front door and I heard a big explosion. It was some guy over at the dry cleaners that Eberhardt's ran.
Mm-hmm.
And he drove up and parked his car in front of Eberhardt's laundry, and somebody had put a bomb in his car, blew it up, injured him seriously. He later died in a bar battle at the cottage bar.
So had he done something that somebody didn't like? That's why
he was just part of the unsavory crowd around.
You say, did we have sort of a Fairbanks mafia?
Sort of.
Yeah.
You got your story. Sorry.
What did you do for that headline when he asked you? Did you come up with one?
Oh, that was not that day. That was an example of sometimes.
Right.
I went over and the guy was on his back, hoping to breathe.
Yeah.
He lived.
Wow.
But he later died at the cottage bar.
Right.
Not at the bar, but afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody didn't like him, so they knocked him off.
Yeah. The car bomb didn't work, so they got him some other way.
Got him another way.
Yeah.
But this one morning, we had a very active, and still do, birders.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had, like at 4:30 in the morning, we'd gather and go out and look for birds. And they'd call me because I'd answer the phone in the newsroom. So if there was a news item coming through locally, I received the first note and sent the call over to the editor. This one morning, I told him, I said, I don't know, we don't have any murders, nothing. Real calm night. He said, well, tell me, we had one column on the front page that was news briefs, just little, you know, about an inch high.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Cross chapter XYZ is going to meet Wednesday at 7 p.m. Or the Nordell Hotel will be closed this weekend because Eva McGowan is having a social up in her, you know, people are visiting or something. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Or the college Girl Scouts, too, is going out on the road to Saturday to help in the cleanup.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Right.
Well, this Jim Crouch called in. He was a birder, but then he'd call in. He'd think that whatever the birders were doing that day were the most important thing in town. So he reported that the birders had sighted a blue goose. So I said, what's a blue goose? He said, it's just a goose. They call them blue because of something. So the editor said, okay, let me see what you got in the briefs. So started down the briefs. He said, what's this blue goose business? I said, I don't know. A blue goose is a blue goose. It's a rare goose. So he said, well, give it to me. So he ran it as a headline story, Blue Goose Sighted.
That's desperation.
Well, I say, it made the birder guy very happy.
Oh, they were happy.
That finally somebody realized how
he important. He made a headline.
Yeah. He thought he was so important, it worked. That's great.
I still have a copy of that paper someplace around here. I think it was in that box with all the photos downstairs.
So do you remember some of the quote-unquote big stories you worked on?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. 64 was an earthquake. I worked on that.
Yeah. Was there much effect on the earthquake here in Fairbanks?
No. Not much.
Did you go to Valdez?
Later. So that was the same day that Emil Usabelli died.
Oh.
He was killed at Usabelli Mine.
Yeah.
But his death went unnoticed mostly because everything was... So we have an earthquake. And the publisher had a Jeep. And the editor at that time was named... Assistant editor was John Wilson. So Mr. Snedden came into the newsroom and had a little conference with John Wilson, a couple others, and me. United Press or Associated Press kept publishing whatever they could, any news they could find, they sent out over the wire. There was no news between Fairbanks and Valdez, no contact.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, we better go down the Richardson Highway and see what happened down there. He said, John, you can go, can't you? Yeah, I go. He said, Mike, you go with him. So I drove home and got my duffel bag, which I always carried in my car. It had warm winter boots and warm winter clothes. Came back and we got in the Jeep and headed down to Anchorage. The epicenter was north of of Valdez, and in the general's vicinity of Glen Ellen, in that area. Mm-hmm. So he wanted us to go to Anchorage. So we knew we had to go through the Alaska Range and then the Coastal Range. And there's another range in there someplace. So we took all the survival gear we could muster and headed for Anchorage.
Because at that time the Parks Highway didn't exist.
No. It was completed in 72, I think.
So you had to go the Richardson.
You had to go the Richardson to Glen Ellen. Mm-hmm. So we went down through Glen Ellen. There hadn't been any contact between Fairbanks and Glen Ellen or Sourdough or Paxson. Mm-hmm. So we got down to Glen Ellen. They had outfitted themselves as a rescue area. Mm-hmm. And they had heard from Valdez. Some of the Valdez people made their way up. I found out later that my friend Bonnie Williams and her husband David lived in Goldstream, mm-hmm. and they were shortwave people, that they'd been in contact with Valdez. But I didn't know it till afterwards. But we didn't know where the epicenter was. We didn't know what was happening in Valdez. I also found out later that Florence Weber packed up her gear in Goldstream and headed down there.
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew that she and Al did radio.
Yeah.
Stuff.
And made their way around landslides. Mm. But I didn't know it at the time. I knew there was shortwave contact between Valdez and Fairbanks later. But when it first happened, nobody knew anything because there was no one coordinator.
Right.
So we got to Glen Ellen and talked to some of those refugees. Found out generally what had happened in Valdez, and we headed on down to Anchorage. That's when we started. We had to go through some of that coastal. Mm-hmm. We thought there'd be a lot of problem on the road and landslides you couldn't get around, but we got around everything. There were landslides, but they were minor.
Why did you go to Anchorage and not Valdez?
Because Anchorage is the largest city and they kind of put out the news for the state.
That's where the most damage was going to be.
Well, Valdez was pretty well flattened.
Yeah.
So.
But the population was in Anchorage.
Yeah.
Yeah, Anchorage is a big town.
Yeah.
Jim Moody was down there during the earthquake.
Who?
Jim Moody.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote it out on that high rise.
On L Street.
On L Street.
Oh.
He's on the 10th floor.
Wow, that was the real jiggly part of town. So what did you see when you got to Anchorage?
We saw lots of holes in the road. Houses uprooted. But before we headed down there, we gassed up the Jeep, and we also carried some extra 5-gallon cans of fuel, because it's like over 300 miles to Anchorage. So we got down there, we needed gas. We thought, well, we better gas up right now, because everybody's going to be running for the gas stations and gassing up. So on 4th Avenue, there's a Chevron station. I think it's still there on the right side as you enter Anchorage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's one on the left side as you enter Anchorage. So it was open, so we went in, drove in, and John drove up by a pump, and a guy came out. He says, John said, told him to fill it up. So guy takes the cap off. He had the hose here, took the cap off, had a cigarette in his mouth. And it grew, the ashes were about that long.
Inch long.
I'm standing there thinking, when is this going to blow up? When is this going to blow up? So I backed off. And John, too, I showed him. You know, you're just not thinking in times like that. Guy was in shock.
Yeah.
Because that bluff had been knocked down. He'd just been through a horrible experience. So I didn't say anything to him. I thought, if he's going to blow himself up, he's going to blow himself up and survive the earthquake.
Yeah.
So then we started driving around Anchorage, taking pictures, talking to people, trying to find somebody in the authority. Then we just composed stories and telephoned them back to Fairbanks. And they just transcribed it as we dictated.
Wow.
And they ask us questions, ask us to do certain things, check on this or that. What about those tall buildings? Well, they're still there. Still there. Yep, still there.
When you phoned in a story, did you have it all written out on paper?
And yeah, I had written it on a little tablet.
Yeah, so you weren't just doing it off the top of your head.
I could do that, yeah.
Really?
Probably did some of them.
Yeah.
So then we got downtown to the high-rise area, and if we'd come across anything of real shocking interest, we'd stop and phone.
Where did you find a telephone?
I was going to say, it's kind of hard to find telephones because the telephone poles were damaged too, mm-hmm. knocked over.
Yeah, they must not have had electricity or phone service for a while.
Well, they had phone service.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, it's not like you had a cell phone. You could just stop your car and make a call.
That was amazing to me that we did have that kind of contact.
Yeah.
What was the newspaper in Anchorage at the time?
The editor.
Was it the Anchorage Times?
Anchorage Times.
It was shut down, wasn't it?
And the Anchorage News. The Anchorage News was in the general vicinity of that gas station. It's on kind of a bluff. And it got knocked all flattened.
Really?
It was flattened.
Destroyed?
And what about the Times?
Times was not flattened, but it was very heavily damaged.
So they didn't publish for a while?
No, they didn't have anything to publish with.
Oh, so the stories were you guys.
So then the editor would tell us, well, pack up your gear and come home. So we'd go back to Fairbanks. And in the meantime, they had our stories, and we had our pictures, which they developed right away and put out an earthquake edition. And we published newspapers for at least 1 week. And then we'd batch them up. They were Anchorage bylines because we had sent the story from Anchorage. And we'd batch them up in bundles of 100. Or so. And then we take them to Alaska Airlines and ship them to the Anchorage Times. And the Anchorage Times and the Anchorage News. And Sneddon had verbally agreed to do this. He said, just take them to wherever the refugees are. So that's what they did. They took them to refugee centers. So they'd finally get some news of what was happening. But we published the news in Fairbanks.
Did you call it the Daily News Miner?
Yeah. Well, it had their headlines, too. But a little story that's being published by the Interior newspaper.
Did you save some of those newspapers?
Mm-hmm.
Those would be very interesting.
Yeah, they are. On March 27th, I was sitting at my desk in the afternoon, kind of late afternoon. We got word that Emil Yusubeli had been killed at his mine. So I'm sitting there typing away. It ended up to be a little story in the bottom right corner, page one.
Because of the earthquake.
He got overshadowed.
But the earthquake took all the news space.
No, he died in an accident at the mine.
Mm-hmm.
Was that triggered by the earthquake?
No, it was just before.
Oh, okay.
Earlier in the day.
I see. Okay.
March 27th, 1964.
Hmm. Now, you said something about photographs, so I was wanting to ask you, you would phone your story in.
Mm-hmm.
But the only way to get photos was to take film
carry them
back,
and develop them in Fairbanks.
Now, did you develop your pictures? Mm, or?
Some of them. Mm-hmm.
Did they have a lab at the News Miner?
Yes, a real nice lab. By that time, the News Miner had a full-time photographer. When John Wilson and I were dispatched down to Richardson, the photographer was sent someplace else.
Oh.
There were a lot of places to go. We didn't know where the epicenter was.
Mm-hmm. Did somebody go to Valdez?
I did.
You did?
Mm, the next day.
And what did that look like?
Well, pretty sad. All the homes were still standing. A lot had been destroyed, knocked over. So we'd look in the windows and everything looked pretty good in there, except they'd been washed over with water.
Or by the tidal wave. Or the tsunami.
Yeah. Well, the ground, Valdez at that time was situated on a glacial moraine. It had been forming for centuries, or decades.
Mm-hmm.
And when the earthquake came, it shook everything. And it turned that glacial moraine into mud.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pressure from the earthquake forced that mud up into the inside of the houses.
Oh.
Devastated the houses.
Hmm.
Because the ground was thawed underneath the house.
Right.
And the force of the earthquake could break the surface. And so you look inside, and they were devastated by water.
Mm-hmm.
But outside, they looked pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
They're all framed, so there was a lot of
flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Walker rode that out with his dad.
He was a boy.
Oh, Governor Walker, that's right.
He was 12 years old.
Yeah. Governor Egan was from Valdez also.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, was he in Valdez at the time?
He wasn't there. He was in Juneau. But he went there the very next day.
Did they have Red Cross back then? American Red Cross?
Yeah, they did. I don't remember any large Red Cross presence in Valdez, but they had Red Cross.
Was there Red Cross in Anchorage?
In Anchorage? Oh, yeah. Big time.
Yeah, well, Valdez was probably a pretty small town back then.
Very small.
How many people did they lose in Valdez?
I think it was 31 or 32. Most of them on the dock.
On the dock, yeah. That's the tragic story, though. The dock collapsed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just went under.
And then villages of Prince William Sound, Chenega and Port Graham, and the village of Chenega, I think, was wiped out.
Chenega.
Yeah.
That's down on Kodiak Island, or that area.
That's Prince William Sound someplace.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, did any reporters go out there to those places?
Later, yeah.
Oh, later.
But at first, they don't know we didn't know if they had an airport to land on or not, or the road to Anchorage, we didn't know.
Yeah.
There were some fishers in it.
Yeah, well,
but not many.
Yeah, because Seward also was very significantly damaged.
And as I said, there were some rock slides on the way to Anchorage, but they weren't major.
Did you bring newspapers to Valdez also?
Yeah. They were the only newspaper in the state. Sent some to Juneau by Alaska Airlines. And most of them went to Anchorage.
Was Alaska Airlines in business in 1967?
Mm-hmm. 64. Oh, 64? Mm-hmm. Wien was more the dominant airline, wasn't it? For passengers?
For the state, yes. They flew to Barrow and Fort Yukon.
But Alaska Airlines was starting up?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, what other stories? Well, I guess how many times did you go to Anchorage and stuff for that earthquake coverage?
I did that for about a week and a half. Then I was assigned to go to Valdez. In the meantime, we'd heard from Valdez, relayed through Glen Allen and shortwave operators. There were quite a few of them operating then, but we didn't know who they were.
Right.
And there might have been others. I'm sure there were others, because the shortwave club here was, or community was mm-hmm. pretty broad.
Yeah. But so then after that week in of doing papers up here, did the Anchorage Times, were they able to get doing their own printing again?
Eventually they did, but I'm not. I don't know the time frame.
Okay. Do you have another big story that you remember working on?
Oh yeah. The 67 flood.
Mm-hmm. That was here in Fairbanks.
Yeah. At that time, the Anchorage Times printed papers and sent them up to us.
Yeah, well, the News Miner, was the News Miner offices in the same building it is now?
No, they were on Second Avenue.
Oh, on the south side of the river. So they totally got flooded.
Then the 67 flood came. I did a lot of coverage on that. The editor just took a map of Fairbanks and divided it up. He said, "Mike, that's your area." So took off with my camera, came home here, didn't have any problem getting home, left my car parked in the railroad tracks where University Avenue covers, across the railroad tracks, and water there only got about that high.
4 feet? 3 feet?
Hmm?
3 feet high, maybe? When you say that high, what is that?
Yeah, maybe 12 inches.
Okay.
And the only damage to my car. Most people lost their cars.
Yeah.
But I was supposed to cover all that college area, the university, the airport, and everything in between. So I couldn't do it by car. I had to do it by boat. So I just left my car there on the railroad tracks because it was the highest elevation on University Avenue.
And how did you get there? Did you go University Avenue or College Road?
I just drove from here
down. You were at home. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I went back after the flood and retrieved my car. The only problem I had with it afterwards was that real muddy, dirty, sandy water got into the brakes.
Oh.
I had to have the brakes cleaned.
Yeah. But it started. It didn't get into the engine.
No.
Well, that's good.
How'd you get a boat ride?
Just put your thumb out. That's how it was.
And then you did your own photography. The photographer mm-hmm. didn't come with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 1965, we were expected to come back with pictures. But in 65, they bought 3 Rolodexes. And with camera cases, and they gave one to me and said, when you come back with a story, we want you to bring a picture with you. So I started taking pictures with a Rolodex.
The Rolleiflex.
Flex.
Rolodex is the
address. Yeah, it's coming to me now.
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure. I thought,
my brain's catching up with you.
Take picture. I knew what you meant, but I want to make sure somebody listening to this doesn't think you take pictures with one of those old address card things, but they probably wouldn't know what a Rolodex was either.
You still have that old Rolleiflex, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Probably took good pictures. Those are good cameras.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very good cameras.
So, do you remember what kind of stories you wrote about for the flood? Where you went?
Well, the flood got up to my kitchen chair height, or it came in the door and washed everything out the back door.
That was on 10th? Or not up here?
Yeah.
The flood came all the way up here?
Not up, no, downtown.
Downtown.
In my assignment area.
Okay.
And a lot of the houses in town were old.
Where's the first place you went?
Yeah, when you got down there by the railroad tracks and got in a boat, where'd you go?
Wherever the boat was headed.
Mm-hmm. And was the boat just running around rescuing people, looking for people that needed?
I would just have to get to the airport. Can you take me out there? He said, no, I'm going the other way. He said, he's going out there. You know, just, he had to hustle for a ride.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out the governor was coming in.
And that was Walter Hickel.
And he would be treated to the helicopter experience. So I thought, well, I better hang out with Wally. So
you headed to the airport?
So I hitched a ride to the airport.
To meet Hickel.
And you knew him personally, right?
Mm-hmm. So anyway, he came in from Anchorage and landed, and there was a military chopper there. So I went out and took a picture. He loved to get his picture in the paper, so. And he knew me by first name, so. He said, what are you doing, Mike? I said, well, I came out here to take a picture of you and other important people. And he said, well, what's it not like around? Well, there's water up here. So he had an assistant, chief of staff, I think. His name was Paul Ryan, coincidentally.
Paul Ryan?
His name was Ryan.
Mm.
And he, you know, he was the governor's assistant, so he knew everything. Kind of full of himself.
Mm.
And so they were standing there out on the tarmac with an airplane that just came in from Anchorage and then a helicopter that's whizzing around. Well, Hickel was making his own plan. Of course, there were disaster people here to make decisions for some of us and to offer background information. They had radios, so they knew pretty well what had happened between Anchorage and Glen Ellyn. Nothing said. I told Hickel that I'd just come back from Anchorage. Well, he didn't. I said, oh, yeah, we came back and put out a newspaper and sent it down. He said, oh, I didn't know you did that. Well, I said, well, you were at the refugee center, I guess. He said, yeah, I was there. That's where I got my paper.
Well, that was for the earthquake. Now, in the flood, Hickel came up
this
as...
This is a flood.
Oh.
So anyway, he said, well, the university was and all of Northwest Fairbanks was my assignment area. And he said, well, you're up to date. He said, well, why don't you come with me?
Mm.
And Ryan kind of moves in. And Hickel said, well, Paul, you take the next chopper. He said, Mike knows what's going on here, so I'm going to take her with me. So I climbed aboard with him.
Yeah.
Got a lot of aerial shots.
Yeah.
Was it a military helicopter?
Mm-hmm.
Was it?
Well, that seems like a pretty honorable position to go fly around with the governor.
Oh, yeah.
You got the scoop on that story.
Well, just like Greeny, if he saw a camera and somebody using it, he ran to get in front of it.
I'd say you definitely scooped that story.
I guess.
You got there first.
So Governor Hickle went wherever the military people had a lot of communications. If there was any bigwig coming to town, Hickle would know about it. So he'd say to the driver or the pilot, well, we're going to the next place we're going is, okay, Governor, we can't land there. Why not? Well, it's all water. Oh. So then he kind of directed the tour. And he got out in boats and went, he had to go by, to go from the News Miner downtown to the airport, I went by boat
right.
all the way. Riverboat.
Right.
So your office was still functional? It was just flooded in the...
Who's that?
The office on 2nd Avenue, was it flooded?
No, we were moved over to the current location.
Oh, okay.
By then, we...
And it didn't flood?
Yeah, it did. About that much water in the building.
A foot of water?
But you could still go there and work?
We could still work. We wore boots and sloshed around.
And the papers printed?
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't get back home up here, could you?
Yeah, I could go get in my car and drive home.
Go by boat to your car
then
and
I'd
drive home.
Go back on duty and go drive down there and park my car again.
Mm-hmm.
Wait for a boat.
So did you come home or did you work 24 hours?
I didn't come home for most of that time. And I slept one night up in the ACS building.
Alaska Communications
mm-hmm.
building? Where is that?
It was over near the entrance to Fort Wainwright.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Right at the corner of airport and...
Yeah, a big Napa store in there.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a two-story building.
Hmm. So when you were flying around with Hickle, yeah, where could you land the helicopter?
The high spots.
Which, such as? Where did you land so he could get into a boat?
Oh, let's see. The cemetery was pretty high.
What about Fort Wainwright?
No, we didn't go to Fort Wainwright.
Which cemetery? Birch Hill or 10th Avenue?
10th Avenue, no.
No. The Birch Hill Cemetery.
I can't remember exactly where we landed.
Did you land at Lathrop High School, the Lathrop Hilton?
Landed at the airport or at the high school.
Yeah.
I know that.
Because that's where a lot of people evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did you land at the university?
Landed there, yeah.
Yeah, the university was high ground.
It was the highest spot in my assignment area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where they organized that.
Was Hickle in town longer than a day?
Yeah, he was here a couple of days.
Was he?
No.
But as I recall, he went back to Anchorage and came back the next day.
Mm. There's probably no place for him to stay here.
Oh, he was making arrangements to build a new hotel home. He was.
Yeah. Mm. So what kind of stories did you talk to people and wrote about what people were experiencing?
Yeah. How high was the water? What did you lose? How about your neighbors? Are they safe? We lost some people in that flood.
Oh, you really? Do you remember? I didn't realize that there were deaths associated with that flood.
Nobody prominent.
No, but still.
We had several deaths.
Oh.
Drowns.
Yeah.
Was the Pioneers home in existence?
It just opened.
It just opened?
It just opened.
Did they get them all out okay?
There was only one guest, E.B. Collins. And he was a Republican bigwig decades before. So Hickle was a Republican bigwig. He played that up and made certain he was safe. Yeah, he was the first first guest there.
Huh. Well, I think the Pioneer Home would have been far enough away.
No, it had a lot of water in
it. Did
it? Yeah.
Oh.
It's right off Airport Road.
I know, but so's Lathrop High School, and that was fine. That's why they evacuated people to Lathrop, because it wasn't flooded. But maybe it got close.
Alaska Land got flooded.
Yeah.
Pioneer Park, it just opened, too.
Yeah.
Or Alaska Land, right. Let's see, what else just opened?
So, and did you, when you were a reporter, did you do crime stories?
Crime?
Yeah. That was your beat, too?
Yeah. The police was on my beat. There was one, what I would do, I would go, the police issue a bulletin every day, supposedly with everything that happened. If a car overturned or a shooting occurred at the Rendezvous Club, whatever, they'd have a little thing, I'd go in there. But the city police also did that. And the city police had the ambulance service. So I'd always check the ambulance service, because if they went to a wreck where they had to extricate two people from a wreck, you knew that there was a serious wreck. So you could ask the police about it. So this one morning I went there and I checked. They had gone to, I went to check out the ambulance service. They had picked up a woman out of the 49er Club outside frozen. So I went to the state troopers. And they didn't have anything on their blotter about the murder or the woman. Had her name, description, native. So I knew most everything I needed to know. So the head of the troopers here was then named Don McQueen. And he never, ever trusted reporters, no matter how hard you tried to be straight with him. He had to be straight with the police. Mm-hmm. So I go in there after I'd read the city police blotter and the ambulance records. And I said, what's new today, Don? He said, oh, nothing, same old, same old. And I said, no, it's not. The ambulance took a frozen woman to the morgue. Not the same. He didn't know how I knew that. Well, another thing on my beat was the
coroner.
Not the coroner, the mortician.
Oh, mortician?
I could usually call. I had good relations with him, and that's how I found out about people who'd been killed or there'd been a brawl, something. So,
what was his name?
I can't remember now.
But he was a private mortician?
Yeah.
He wasn't a coroner?
Not the coroner.
Okay.
So you'd call him up and you'd say, hey, Bill, got any bodies?
That's exactly what I'd say. No, it's anybody.
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 Yeah. That's good.
One story I did was a real dramatic death up on the Arctic Slope. And I called, I can't remember his name.
It'll come back to you probably after I'm gone.
Marvin.
Was the mortician?
No, was the death.
He was the guy at the to whom I spoke every day.
Oh, Marvin.
At the
funeral home?
Funeral home.
Okay.
This one day I called it. I said, hi, Marvin. Got any body today? He said, oh, yeah. I said, oh, yeah? Tell me about it. So he told me some man who was also frozen. And they'd flown him in from the North Slope. I said, do you know anything about it? And he said, well, he wanted to go back to Texas. And the bush plane came into the camp and picked everybody up to take them out. And they had a terrific windstorm. They got out to the plane, and here comes Mr. Texas with everything he went up the North Slope with. Wearing his cowboy boots, his Levi's, light shirt. And a suitcase. And I got the story from the operator up there, too. He worked on a geophysical crew, and we called them to get comments from them. He said, yeah, well, it was time for him to go out for R&R. He was just determined he was going to get on that airplane and get the hell out of there, go back to Texas. So he took everything he had up there, and there wasn't room in the plane for all that weight. So the pilot said, well, I can't take you because I can't lift up. You know, it was a bad storm. Can't get this thing off the ground if we take you and your gear. I go, well, I ain't going on back. I ain't staying here. I'm going back to Texas. So he turned around and walked back to the camp. He couldn't find the camp. It was blowing snow. So he didn't show up at the camp, and got to town, they couldn't find, he wasn't a passenger, so put out a big search for him, found him. I talked to Marvin. He told me a little bit about it. I said, well, tell me what this guy's wearing. He says, well, guess he's from Texas, wearing big old cowboy boots, a cowboy hat, Levi's, light shirt. What color is the shirt? So when I wrote the story, I had a complete description of what he was wearing. They never did figure out where I got it. Got it from the mortician.
It's good to know people.
Hmm?
It was good to know people as a reporter.
Mm-hmm. Well, he trusted me and I trusted him.
Yeah.
I mean, you develop those trusting relationships. But they never did figure out where I got the complete description of them. It was sad story.
Yeah, what year was that? Late 60s?
That was about 1966.
Mm. Poor guy.
Yeah.
They found him the next day. But he got lost in one of those blizzards up there.
Yeah, it's easy to do.
He couldn't retrace his steps.
Yeah, you can't see across the street, let alone, so it's easy to get lost. Mm.
Stories like that would crop up that I'd have to cover. Well, the editor knew I had some initiative and could find details on stuff like that without turning the town upside down.
Did you cover the discovery of oil?
Oh, yeah.
68?
That might be a whole nother interview.
Yeah.
Should we hold off on that for next time?
If I'm still around.
Or you want to keep going and tell that story?
Yeah, it was another time I hooked a ride with Hickel.
Okay.
To the Discovery Well.
You can keep going if you want. I don't want to tire you out.
I'm kind of tired of the flood, except I had 32 refugees here at my house.
Wow.
And Libby was at the Girl Scout camp at Birch Lake.
And oh, right.
George was, he was a house mother.
For the refugees?
Had 32 of them.
Wow.
Of course, I knew most of them.
Yeah, because you weren't here that much. You were out.
Oh, I wasn't here at any time.
Yeah.
George was the house mother.
Because your husband wasn't alive anymore.
He was up at Barrow.
Oh, he was in Barrow.
Oh, someplace on a slope.
Okay. He wasn't here either.
Oh, he was really worried about us. He wanted to come. I called him at the camp up there and told him everything was fine, but he thought he should be here to protect his family. And I told him what was going on. He said, well, I don't know what I could do to help you. So just moral support is all.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to be away from your family when mm-hmm. there's something like that going on. Must have been hard for you, too, with Libby
yeah,
down there.
You have all the responsibilities.
Well, and also you couldn't be home. You were out doing your job.
Well, Jim calmed down because I told him who the refugees were. One of them was one of his best friends who could go out in the middle of the tundra in mid-December and start a cat up. And so he was here.
Who was that?
John Clark and his family. Had no electricity, so they couldn't cook. So John had a welding outfit in his pickup. So he just went outside, put a frying pan on some rocks, and started cooking with his welding machine. Them people know how to take care of themselves.
Yeah. Very ingenious. A lot of ingenuity in that
mm-hmm.
time period. Do you remember who else was at the house?
Lena Phipps
and Oscar, her husband Oscar.
Oscar?
Not Oscar, Oscar.
Lena and Lila May.
Lila May King
and Lena Phipps were sisters. And
now was Lila May here or she was?
They lived downtown.
Okay.
Lila May went someplace else during the flood?
I went, after I parked my car first time. Before that, I had driven up on the campus, and I walked into the big room there in Wood Center. And had a couple of chairs like this, about the size of that love seat rocker. I walked in, and there was Lena and Oscar and Lila May. They were all 80 plus. So I took them out here. Because
mm-hmm.
Oscar just gotten out of the hospital with heart problems. So they got my room. There was a double bed in there. I reserved that for Oscar and Lila May.
Lena.
Hmm?
Oscar and Lena were married.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lila May was married to the guy that was the radio expert.
Yeah. He wasn't here. He was at a radio center someplace.
You've talked about him in other interviews.
Yeah, you talked about him when up in Barrow.
The king, yeah.
Yeah. And then, do you remember other people who were here at your house?
Mm-hmm. Leo Brown and his wife, Freddie, and their daughter, two daughters. And somebody I never saw before, I don't know who it was.
Yeah. There's probably a lot of that, strangers in other people's houses.
Yeah. All those people I mentioned, you know, they've been living out in the bush or in trap lines, things like that, where they could survive just about any place.
Yeah.
Knew how to do it. If they had to, they would have gone out and trapped some rabbits or something.
Mm-hmm.
As it was, I'd bring them boxes of stuff from the refugee center.
Do you remember anybody else that was out here?
That's it.
What about the men in halls?
No, I think they were on the campus.
Okay.
I think they might have been in their house. You know, we were the lucky ones up here in the hills.
Yeah.
Some homes got so devastated.
Yeah.
One thing John Clark taught me was water is water and it seeks its own level.
Mm-hmm.
The first flood came in 67. Then about 10 days or 2 weeks later, there was a threat of another flood.
Oh.
And he was out here visiting with Jim, and Jim had come to town in the meantime. He said, what have you been up to, John? He said, I just filled my basement with the water. You filled it on purpose? He said, well, last time it got filled up to the brim with muddy water. I had to clean out my furnace, clean out mud everywhere. So, he said, if we're going to have another flood, it's going to be met with clean water in my basement. So water, whether it's clean or dirty, seeks its own level. So that was the smartest flood prevention thing I heard.
And did that next flood come?
It came, but not with the intensity of the August flood.
Mm-hmm. And his house was right down there on Slater Drive.
Oh, yeah.
So it's real close to the river.
Yeah, it had lots of water in it.
Yeah.
Well, that guy, you know, he's just a construction worker all his life, trucker. But he knew if he flooded the basement, it wouldn't get any fuller.
Yeah.
If it was full of clean water, it wouldn't be full of dirty water.
Slater made me think, if I was going to ask you when you worked for the News Miner, was Chuck Gray there?
Oh, yeah.
He's the publisher? Or?
Publisher emeritus.
But when you were there, he was...
Yes, he was there.
He came after Snedden?
Yeah. But he was also working there as an expert in presses and color printing. He brought color printing to the News Miner.
Where did he come from originally?
He was born here.
Was he?
Really?
Huh. Hmm.
But he somehow learned about printing presses and all that.
Chuck Gray?
Mm-hmm.
He studied. He didn't sit around smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee like some people. He spent his time productively.
Did he ever do any news reporting and write articles?
I think he did early on when he could still go up and shoot polar bears.
Yeah, I know he was a big game hunter.
Mm-hmm. Used to fly up there and knock off a bear or two.
Yeah, I didn't know if he ever did any of the reporting for the paper.
Well, if he was up on a flight someplace and he ran across a news story, he'd phone it in.
One of the editors that came along that was one of everyone's favorites was Dave Galloway.
After the big flood, we had a change in leadership. There was a man named Marvin something.
He was an new editor?
New editor. He had a lot of experience with AP. Merlin Spencer,
okay.
And he came up, and we were kind of a ragtag news crew, but he realized there was some value to each one of us. For example, if I had a story that had to be in by 8 o'clock in the morning, I'd get it. They could rely on it, getting being there.
What was the deadline? It was an afternoon paper, wasn't
5
it?
5 p.m.
Oh.
For news stories.
So was it a morning paper or an afternoon paper?
Afternoon
paper. So you have to get in by 5 p.m. the day before.
Yeah. Some deadlines were like that. Then for the daily news, it was usually about 10 in the morning for the news stories.
When did Dave Galloway come in to the picture?
I'm trying to think of... He came before the earthquake. About 1962, I think, a man named David Galloway came to Fairbanks. Really a good editor, good writer.
Great sense of humor.
Snedden, the publisher, found him someplace, I don't know where, but he was good.
And you guys got to be pretty good friends.
Yeah.
You were good friends with him.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife was Nancy, and she taught school at Lathrop, didn't she?
And smoked cigarettes and played bridge.
Mm-hmm. And they had 3 kids, and they always had a black lab. Their kids were, we got pictures of us playing together.
So I would go back to Merlin Spencer. Did he make changes at the paper when he came along?
A few, yeah. But one thing that distinguishes him, in my mind, was he was with the AP for years. He was aboard the Missouri when Hirohito, or was it Hirohito, signed
the peace treaty for...
Peace treaty, end of the war.
End of the war, oh,
over there in Tokyo Bay or someplace. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow. So did he professionalize the office a little bit?
A little bit. Your ragtag group? A little bit. Most of us he couldn't professionalize. He recognized the value in each one of us, so he went along with us.
Was he after Galloway?
You said he was after the flood.
After Galloway.
Yeah.
Oh. And Galloway went on to be editor of Los Angeles Times.
Yeah. Well, it was the Los Angeles County edition.
Oh, okay.
For the Times.
Okay.
He moved on.
But it sounds like the editors weren't here for very long. They moved on.
Mm-hmm.
And her niece...
Hmm?
Your niece ended up working for him one summer when she was going to college. She was an intern at the Times.
Mm-hmm.
And she worked with Dave Galloway.
Well, funny.
Her name was... Her name's Kath... Is it Catherine Fitzpatrick?
Pat, I think.
Yeah, anyway, small world.
It goes through the family.
Yeah, small world.
He was a fine guy, David.
Mm. Well, it's been over an hour. Are you tired out?
I was about to tell you, I'm hurting from my toes up.
I can see that you're looking uncomfortable, so why don't we stop for today and we'll talk more about News Miner next time.
We'll talk about... Discovery
Wall. Yep, that sounds great. Thank you very much.